Blog Talk Radio.
To the Investigator's Report, an in-depth look at some of the world's greatest mysteries and topics of interest. So for the next hour, we ask you to sit back, relax, and fasten your seatbelts as we explore and detail areas in our history, ancient history, biblical history, world religion and philosophy, and unexplained phenomena.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Gary Purefoy with another live version of the Investigator's Report. We're very, very glad to have you with us. It is Monday, November the 9th, and we have been waiting very, very long for this date. This is a show that we have looked forward to for quite some time. And it's really, personally, it's a big show, too, because, you know, as many times as I had this gentleman on my show before, this is his first time coming on live, which should be a great experience as well. Well, I have him with me right away, and without any further ado, I want to welcome back to the Investigator's Report, Mr. Michael Tesserion. Welcome back, Michael.
Thanks, Gary. It's nice to be on. Nice to talk to you.
It's always good to talk to you, and usually we touch base once a year with everything that you're doing, so you've made a special exception to come with us on this live version here in November, and I greatly appreciate that. But we also have good reason to do so, because you are now coming down the stretch in producing the second volume of your DVD, which is entitled Architects of Control. Now, Volume 1 has already been released and is doing quite well. Volume 2, you are now in the process of finishing that. Tell us about what's going on with that right now, Mike.
Well, absolutely. It was a series. And we had such a positive response, you know, in the last 10 months. I mean, the first one hasn't been out that long, ultimately. It's still going strong, and we took a bit of a break, and then been basically on the road constantly now since March, basically, from March 4th, I think. We went to the Balkans, you know, to Macedonia and also to Serbia. To film there pretty much before the tourist season starts, because that would have ruined it. So we had to kind of go early because these places are swamped with tourists, especially Belgrade.
Right.
And so on, you know, being so close to Greece and what have you. We didn't really want that. The locations we were heading to, we wanted them to be, you know, we didn't want to stand in line for like hours, you know, at these various churches and other places where these beautiful icons are, you know, Constantine. Yeah, we were doing a section on religion, and so Constantine was actually born in Macedonia at a place called Nice,
wow.
N-Y-S,
mm-hmm.
And there's really some fantastic history there. So, but the trouble with that is, of course, that it's a tourist attraction, as I say, being close to Greece, and there's some beautiful climate there, and skiing, and all of these kinds of things. So if you make a mistake and go at tourist time, you know, you're going to get lots of crowds and a lot of things we didn't want to, you know, wait around and sort of edit out. So we had to make sure we went there early, actually, like about March, April. And it worked out really great because there wasn't any tourists at all. And the roads were empty and it was easy to get through the borders. And it was incredible, you know. So it was really great fun there, actually, you know, because actually Belgrade is a very ancient city. It actually means the White City. And it was great to also be steeped in the history there. You know, we were doing a section on religion. So it's going to be great, you know, with the juxtapositions of the ancient churches and these fantastic old shrines that they have there. It was really fun to do that. And then we moved on in like through June and July. We were in the States on the West Coast filming there, and then in Ireland recently, you know. So it's just like, you know, probably in England in a couple of months, you know, maybe in Scotland doing some filming. So it's kind of eclectic, you know, from putting all this together, but it's really, really great to be going around and basically getting our own footage as well, so that it's going to be such a fantastic cinematic project as well as a good, strong documentary on the subject matter, you know, like a very nice continuation of the first one.
Right, and it sounds like there's more locations that you've hit, so it will be quite an undertaking and will be quite a production, to say the least. Well, we'll be talking about that work, Architecture Control. Of course, we'll be talking about primarily the first volume and then talk some about the second volume. And if you'd like to join the discussion, folks, you can call in at area code 914-338-0519. That number again is 914-338-0519. Also, you may ask Michael about his other books. I mean, even with his book about 2012, Atlantis and Genetic Manipulation, and many of his other works, which you're very well familiar with, if you go up to his website, which is michaeltessarian.com, and, you know, be free to ask him any question. But like I said, we're going to deal with Architects of Control. Now, in the first film, you introduced a lot of historical information, which was a combination of what we've seen in movies, in music, TV, and then some of the representations that we see as it pertains to the pharmaceutical industry and the healthcare industry. Kind of talk about those elements that were introduced in Volume 1 of Architects.
You're speaking specifically about the mind control, or
the mind control? Yes.
Well, exactly. This was the focus in the first one, to introduce that subject to people who maybe never heard of it before, and also to look at, because, you know, the whole series is based on men, and it's one of the first, you know, projects to really fuse the subjects of psychology and conspiracy. And of course, it means that you are not treating either one of those subjects in a familiar way, because when you combine, it's brilliant to combine those two things. That's our main interest. It also means that you're redefining psychology, you know, because, of course, psychologists generally, even though they may be critics of society, I can't think of a single one that actually is conspiratorial, if you want to use that word. They certainly don't talk about secret government, hidden government. They never address the mass control being a conscious, willful, you know, phenomenon. In other words, they never talk about being by design. And in the chat, in the introduction to volume two of the Irish Origins, I went into this a lot, about how even though psychologists will sit in their think tanks and often in their psychiatrists and their laboratories, they absolutely know that there's a thing called consensus trance, and they absolutely know that man is susceptible, particularly under trauma, you know, susceptible to influence, but they hesitate to ever mention anything about a big brother. It's just not done. Even the post-Freudians, who are the most incredible critics of society, and they're the most poignant and, I think, you know, the most accurate sort of critics of modern society and how parents, you know, bring up children and how the whole authority structure works, even they will, you know, never, as far as I can tell, talk about an actual big brother. So if you go to people like R.D. Lang, who's a world-famous psychologist, you know, before he passed away, he was a huge critic of the various ways that the human being is molded by his society. And yet again, there was never a real focus on, you know, an actual entity like Big Brother or anything like that. So it's just not done within psychology for a whole multiplicity of reasons. And then you go over to the conspiracy movement, and what do you find there? Consciousness, as we've talked about before, being completely left at the door. Finger pointing. You know, mm-hmm. it's them, right. it's the Jews, it's the Jesuits, it's the Illuminati, and this has been okay. You know, I'm not against it, because it's important that people do know about all these various sort of heads of the Hydra, but, or branches of the tree. But it doesn't work, you see, if you're just continually pointing fingers. So what we wanted to do then is say, look, let's get up to, we're hoping that people are up to speed on the fact that there is a hidden government, a hidden establishment. But my God, what is man doing himself to lend himself to mind control? Mind control is not all about some, you know, spooky, sort of weird, hidden, shadowy, a bogeyman zapping the human mind. And I feel that too many people in the conspiracy movement want to feel that way. It's a typical human response to shrug off personal responsibility. And it's like, if we could just get rid of them, if we could just get, you know, Blair out of power, mm-hmm. if we could just get a better, you know, sort of goon in the White House, if we could just, you know, end tyranny and have world peace, you know, all of these platitudes, all of this kind of nonsense politically, then, you know, the world will be wonderful and we'll join hands and it'll be just like save the world. You know, and you have this kind of very naive, almost infantile type of thought processes when man is not addressing who he is psychologically. Now, to answer your question, why do we deal with mind control in the first one and in the series, why have I dealt with it in another work? Is because obviously the elite know everything about psychology.
Mm-hmm.
We may be leaving it at the door. We may not be joining up these two things and tying these two things together. But you can better believe that these Jekyll and Hydes, these Dr. Strangeloves, these Dr. Frankensteins are 100% aware of what makes a person tick. And that's why we have to make this absolutely fundamentally clear in the first, you know, DVD. Henrik and I and Frederick, we were absolutely convinced, you know, we had to do this because otherwise it's possible for people to grasp what we're talking about. If your enemy is completely psychologically empowered over you, obviously it follows that we need to at least then have the same tools in our hands, the same weapons. So that's why we did that, because then you can show the means that we did, and through, you know, cameoing people like Jim Keith, who talked about it extensively, or even Alex Constantine. It's a tremendous subject. Of course, no one DVD could ever do justice to it. But at least by introducing the theme of this, what we're really hoping to show is that, look, your controllers, the people who run every aspect of your life,
mm-hmm.
from the time you're born, you know, in the hospitals, all the way up to the time you die, these people are completely aware of your psychology, way so. And they're even in the process of creating an infrastructure that is going to sort of, in a way, continue the dehumanizing process. So they're armed to the teeth with psychological knowledge about our libido, about our instincts, our drives. They may call it DNA and genetics, but that's just a ruse. What they're really all at, they're not really so much interested in controlling our biology. They're actually interested in controlling our psychology, but they create these red herrings in order to lead us away from this fact. So our point is, you know, sort of we're trying to interest our audience in this and try to wean them into this idea that the controllers are thoroughly versed in the psychology of human beings. They know the anatomy of the psyche very, very well, and everything they do is based on that. So we now need to start introducing the subject so that we have we're up to speed on the same tool. Otherwise, just working politically or religiously or in some other way, like I've said before, or being sort of like just a rebel without a cause, you know, none of this is going to work. None of it has worked, and it's not going to work in the future.
Folks, you're listening to the Investigative Report, the live version on Blog Talk Radio here. I'm with my good friend and special guest, Mr. Michael Tsarion. We're discussing Architects of Control. We're detailing and looking back on Volume 1. Volume 2 will be released somewhere down the road, but they are in the process of wrapping that film up. But again, and I'm going to take advantage of this opportunity at this point. Folks, you can call in if you have any questions for Michael at 914-338-0519. That's 914-338-0519. There was an excerpt played from a seminar that you given or talk that you gave, and I believe it was in the Esoteric Agenda, where you had mentioned, they took that excerpt where you had stated that the game in which the manipulators play is almost that of like chess, and that they know us. I mean, they're versed with a lot of information regarding the times, the seasons. They have a lot of information on who we are. Could you revisit that thought? Because it was really, what it did when I heard that, it really disclosed, and for those who would never even be acquainted or realize, it disclosed that it would woke people up to the fact that, hey, we need to wake up and we need to get astute about what we're doing. Talk about that in terms of from a chess game perspective.
Well, you see, this is a motif that is used in masonry, where you do have this very conspicuous checkerboard motif. I mean, it's really definable, you know. And you have even individuals from the Fabian Society who've spoken about it being like a sort of a game. And even in their rhetoric, and even in their sort of tone, you're listening to some of these people or reading their writings, you know, whether it be sort of Francis Bacon or Bertrand Russell or any of the individuals who've been interested in this sociological phenomenon of how to control the herd. It's from their own works. They speak of us in a very, they speak of mankind in terms that appear to be, you know, like a game, like they're sort of manipulating pieces on a board. So my personal take on that has always been to use the symbolism. If they are using it, it's sometimes cool to sort of co-opt some of their rhetoric. So I've always talked about how if we need to look at it maybe as a game. Ultimately, you see, what they're doing is not a game, but the way they play it out in society is a game. And they also play it this way very much with their own members, especially in the early stages. This is what all this fraternity malarkey is, where, you know, people are filtered through the system. And I've always referred to the hierarchical system that they use as being basically a kindergarten for psychopaths. These are fraternities for a very important reason. And I'm even speaking on the school level, in colleges, in high school, and so forth, and then further up when you start joining more sort of pan-Masonic organizations or what have you, they are literally, you know, to filter out good men is basically what they are. And this can be proven. Henrik and I have done some interviews, you know, on the Brotherhood of Death, where we really look at this process of the hierarchy and also how it's designed to filter out good men. So they even play a certain game. And don't forget that masonry itself is filled with sort of what we would call rituals and strange, bizarre, dramatic types of rites, which again, from what can be seen as some sort of a game, you know, like a pantomime, some sort of theater. There's a lot of drama involved in this. So, and the British intelligence, by the way, in the especially colonial days when they had their empire, used to speak of something called the Great Game. Did you know that? I mean, they actually used the term the Great Game.
No, not at all. It's the first time I've heard that.
Yeah, it was a secret, British intelligence. The very higher-ups within British intelligence, whether they were in Africa or when they were operating, you know, within India, this is often the term that they used. So, again, I look at it by saying, okay, in this game, why? What is the meaning of the black and white squares, you know? And one of the best ways to explain it is simply that the black squares represent ignorance and the white squares represent enlightenment or knowledge. You know, white being a symbol of illumination or what have you. So are they the illumined ones? You know, do they look at us as being the dark ones, you know, the ones who are completely enshrouded in the ignorance? And can we change that dynamic? And, of course, other people will come along and say, oh, no, the black squares represent them because black squares represent occult knowledge. So, you know, and I'm open to that. I'm just giving metaphors. You can see it in any way you want. And actually, from a metaphysical point of view, the checkerboard does represent light and darkness or day and night, just like the yin-yang symbol, you see. So it has a multiplicity of meanings. I was just using a simple general metaphor to explain that these individuals occupy the white squares of knowledge, we occupy the black squares of ignorance. And we have to change that dynamic. And we're kind of allowed to do it. There is a dynamic there where knowledge is the key. And in my work, in the solutions aspects of what I do, I very much focus on this, that certainly one of the greatest laws is never to combat evil with the tools or the weapons that they've provided for you to do that. You know, this is one of the games, like a duel, you know, where somebody comes over, opens a box and says, choose your weapon.
Right.
In this duel, that is out the window right away. You do not choose the sword or the rapier or the the musket, or the, you know, whatever it is, the gun, you know, the pistol that they're offering you. This is what we have been doing, and I'm not saying that the people who've done this are not brilliant people. And then, well, they did. They were heroic, but fundamental mistake. And again, it's rooted in not having psychological understanding of evil. If you're just charging headlong like some mad bull at this red cloak of evil, with only political understanding, political knowledge, then they're going to win every time because they're the masters of the game. It's like a ballet for them, and we're just clumping around like Frankenstein. It's pathetic. And so even though there may be one or two elements of progress, ultimately you're not going to shake their edifice at all, until people get savvy with some of the arcane knowledge that they have. And as you know yourself, look at the backlashing I get for even talking about using occult knowledge against the occultists, or how I will talk about, you know, using magical aspects or divination just to even bring up these anecdotes, just to even explain what I'm talking about, just to introduce my theories, is tantamount to having backlash from people who haven't even got the, you know, the quotient of intelligence to understand, to follow you from the beginning, middle, and end. They're already accusing you of something. So, you know, again, it's amazing to me how this is the case. It's fascinating as well. I don't take it personally. It's just fascinating to me that the moment that you try to address this issue, that number one, don't fight the enemy with the tools that it provides for you, and two, start getting into the occult knowledge that they use so that you can be armed up, you're automatically labeled all sorts of different things. It's fantastic. It's really fascinating.
Well, it's also been, you and I have talked about this before plenty of times, that it's also been a part of their detailed apparatus, or their deception, if you may, to keep individuals away from the esoteric arts, to keep them away from divination, to keep them away from anything that would resemble the occult, in order to maintain their control over their thought process. So
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, I mean, so it is, and that's why I say it's very, very important that we understand this. Now, recently, we've been seeing, talked about every day, healthcare, you know, and the whole fight down in Washington with a healthcare bill. But what's also being talked about is the whole issue with the swine flu and the vaccination thereof. You and I have touched on this before. In fact, the last time when we did a taped show of Architects earlier in the year, as we came to the tail end of the show and we ran out of time, I wanted to ask you, so I'll pick up where I left off there, in terms of, and now it's different. I mean, we're actually looking at a potential agent which could work as a tool, whereas we could very well see a 28 days later or some type of disaster-like situation, because this came up in my conversation with Stuart Swerlow in terms of the uses of different technological and RF devices, that people, is it very, very possible in your study, in your research and investigation, just give us how you reflect on this whole issue with the swine flu.
Well, it's another one of the weapons that they're using, just in the same way that they made AIDS and had the audacity to tell the world that it was from green monkeys and what have you, until, of course, that was shot down in flames. So they're not above doing this. There are many schools, many sects within the control hierarchy, don't forget. And I've, just for convenience, I've always divided them into two groups. You know, those who want to keep us in a dumbed-down, primitive, troglodyte state, get back to the farms, get back to the mines. You've already got too much privilege. What are we thinking? And you can see those, you can see the effects of that school in America today, in which they're trying to scale back the middle class. This is a thesis that is very strong in the work of Dr. John Coleman, whose work I love a lot. And he has gone into this, and it's Webster Tarpley often talks about it too. And it's important for people to realize that there are these two schools. And the other school, in exactly the same lodge, are those people who believe, no, all we need to do is correctly indoctrinate the troglodyte, Mm-hmm. You know, they're the ones pushing the technology more. They're the ones who are much more involved in the building of the, you know, global village, because they believe that just like in Patrick McGoohan's program, The Prisoner, you know, that if you create the global village, man will be a willing inhabitant. He will want this furnished incarceration. He's already screaming out for it, because they've done such a beautiful job to gut us from our humanness. Man is literally tiring of his humanity. So they're getting ready to create that sort of cyber purgatory in which a basically robotic, anti-human being who's entirely identified with his masters, who are alien, of course, in their thinking and in their biology and what have you. So there's these two schools. And the first school are these sort of Dr. Strangelovians who really push the agenda of wiping us out, literally culling the herd. You know, they're the Malthusians. They're the people who worked on the virus for AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
And that might have been a test for what is coming, of course. So there are these tremendous dangers that they could, in fact, do this. They're not above it at all, even though they have rivals within their own lodges who don't want that for mankind. And so there's many schools of thought right now. There's even people who are now saying that violence, as we know it, across the world, has decreased enormously through the millennia. You know, there are advocates of saying that violence, as we know it, violence of man, is actually much less than it was, say, in medieval times, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to celebrate that and talk about that and broadcast that and on paper. And they have a lot of data, but, you know, backing this up. And it sounds wonderful until you understand that their definition of violence is purely one-dimensional. They're talking about a violence that is only physical in nature, as if that's the only kind of violence in the world. Again, that's the product of leaving consciousness at the door. Anyone who knows anything about psychology knows that there's many, many, many kinds of violence, not just physical.
Right.
There's also a thing called passive aggression. You know, there's also self-sadism. There's also interjected anger and interjected violence. You can have a society that's walking around with a big smile on their face, hating everyone they meet, hypocrites, or individuals who are so self-loathing. You know, I addressed this in one of my talk in L.A.,
mm-hmm.
and we talked about it in the second disc of Architects of Control, about all the other forms of violence that exist. Those are not as quantified. The Pied Pipers and these sort of pundits who talk about the physical violence decreasing never ever speak about that. You see, they don't want to address that. They just want to say, take a snapshot of history and say, oh, look, man isn't as cruel. You know, he doesn't burn people at the stake anymore, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they may even have a case there that's been given that that's true, that we are less physically violent. What about all the psychological and emotional and energetic violence that goes on in the world? What about all the interjected violence? The violence they talk about is the projected violence, where you projected on another person and, you know, you acted out in the physical world. But today, look at our world. See, when I look at the world today, Gary, I see violence everywhere, even in a society in which appears on the surface to be very quite, you know, relatively peaceful.
Right.
So the person who is psychologically aware knows that when the temperature of interjected anger or self-sadism starts to boil, eventually you have wars again. Eventually you have forms of conflict. So the surveillance, or what I call the paranoid society, is the product of that self-sadism that is psychological in nature. And until man looks at himself psychologically in order to understand how this works, how the paranoia is bred, they'll never understand it. But it ties in with the individuals who, again, to answer your question, they may offer you something and say, hey, look, just like the Gore thing with the global warming, they may create a lot of scare tactics to make you think that these diseases are out there. Hundreds and hundreds of scientists can come along and say, it's not. The internet can be covered with reports saying, don't believe it. But they're working on what? Man's anxiety, man's psychological fear of some external evil. We have to watch it in the commercials for any kind of medication. It's always an evil that's out there. Cancer is always out there. You know, athlete's foot is always some disease or germs out there. Poor old me. Man is so disassociated from the reasons of even disease. And this is how the advertising companies or the pharmaceuticals are able to completely play on this all the time. You know, just apply this topically and you'll be healed. Nobody knows looking at deeper causes of even normal illness. So they can come along with these this propaganda. Now, don't forget that there's also the physical side of it, too. Mm-hmm. Just snap your mind back to, was it the Second World War where they had the Spanish flu, the so-called Spanish flu that killed, I think, three times as many people, you know, as died in the war itself.
Right.
You know, people can look that up. And they're still looking into the genetic reasons of why that happened. And I believe that that was man-made. AIDS has been man-made. The infections of the Native American Indians, and also the South American Indians during the time of Cortez, where the disease, I believe, maliciously spread, willfully spread, in order to decimate those populations. There's even rumors that the fat of Ireland was artificially created. So we do have these sort of genocidal activities. There's no doubt about it.
Now, recently, a few days ago, because in Architects of Control, Volume 1, you discussed some of the mass killings that have taken place, like Oklahoma City, like Columbine, and a few Virginia Tech, if you may, and how they were more or less orchestrated and how they were precipitated in a very, very similar way as we've seen in movies like The Manchurian Candidate. In many other films where, you know, individuals were subjects of some type of mind testing and experimentation where there would be certain triggers that would motivate them to commit certain acts. This particular incident in the military base in Texas was one of a different nature. It was more or less of an individual who no one really not only did not suspect, as we've seen in other incidents, but it was kind of also like along the level of there were other external contributing factors to it. Comment on that. I mean, I'm not trying to try to say that that the taunting and the persecution was a part of that, but are we seeing the possibility of people being more or less triggered in the same way that this soldier was?
Yeah, remember that these are all customized based on the profile of the perpetrator. That's one thing people have to understand when you start studying it. It's based on that person's individual profile. What was their weakness? They study their weaknesses. So this was a perfect case in which they had worked on the weakness of this person. And in the case of even other serial killers, it's fascinating to discover, because I believe many of them have been under mind control, and each individual case is basically unique in that sense. Because everyone has a different psychology.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everyone, their background could have been different. It could have been they're working on father hatred. They could be working on mother hatred.
Mm-hmm.
They could be working on legitimate feelings of rebellion against society. You know, how the outsider.
Right.
Don't forget that the outsider is quite vulnerable, actually, because there's a gray area before the outsider actually finds his complete dharma or his selfhood. He has left the world as we know it, but he may be in this sort of wasteland for a long time before he finds what his real calling is. And they know how to target those kinds of people who have tremendous virtue, a lot of them. And they may have a deep religious sensibility. They may have a great love of mankind. And picking those particular virtues, I believe, just like in drama, just like in the tragic hero, it's some flaw within their character. You know, it's beautifully pointed out in Hamlet. If people read Hamlet, even Act 1, the character goes into this about the single flaw in a person's character.
Mm-hmm.
He's standing on the battlements and he's talking to Marcellus and Horatio, and he's talking about the king, the defect in one man, in a man. And of course, later on you find out in the play, it also pertains to himself. Hamlet has this defect. We all do. We all have one defect in our character. That even though, he says, in the general consensus of things, we may have lots and lots of virtues, but it's just one little flaw. You know, it's almost like what I call the stone in the shoe stops you climbing the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And so these controllers who are very adept at mind control looking, they look for that particular stone in the shoe, so to speak, and they know how to work on that. And then this has been whistleblown in movies like you just mentioned, The Manchurian Candidate, in a couple of episodes of Hawaii Five-O. It used to be run back in the 1960s, and in various other documentaries and dramas. They've actually whistleblown this and showed exactly how this works. And it's all based on a man's own profile. This is what is fundamental, and I think that's what you're alluding to, that we have this great scene in The Architects of Control where we dealt with that, about how they actually worked on this particular individual to find out his own weaknesses. Mm-hmm. And his weakness, he was actually an outsider. He was a person who, you know, was he found himself to be too aggressive in normal jobs, and he kept getting fired because he basically was a leader type.
Right.
And then they targeted him for that. They said, yeah, he's a leader, so let's work on that particular virtue that this guy has. And this is very much how it works within the fraternities. It's very much also how it works in the military.
Mm-hmm. Well, notice how, this is one thing that I've definitely noticed. And folks, you're listening to the live version of the Investigative Report here on Blog Talk Radio. I'm Gary Purifoy with my special guest, Mr. Michael Tesserion. We still are taking calls. The phone number is 914-338-0519. What I've noticed in the Columbine situation, even the Virginia Tech situation, the way, and now even with this, the way these things are timed, too, is very curious. Because, see, now what it does is that it gives, it almost revitalizes the whole issue in terms of our war in the Middle East. It revitalizes the sense of suspicion and fear of thinking, well, they live among us. Who's going to do this next? It seems like they've orchestrated. In the case with Virginia Tech and Columbine, it was the whole issue with gun control. So there is almost a political manipulation being used with these events. Would you agree with that?
I do. And also we have to be very cognizant of the ritualistic use of even terms like Virginia. That has a history. In fact, that has a history that goes back to ancient times, into Babylon. The very term, they do these things on certain calendar dates. They do them at the point of certain conjunctions. They do them at certain times. They're part of a whole elaborate ritual, which I've gone into a lot, and other colleagues like Ellis Taylor and others have worked on this. And there's a few others in America who are specific to a certain extent. But I'd say that Ellis Taylor and a few others have been more specific going into this. Richard Hoagland has pointed out some of these things. We have to be aware of the broad picture as well, that how these mannequins are used to work on the anxiety of people, of course, to keep us in terrible fear. Because fear is the key here. Fear is the mind killer. Mm-hmm. And but even the use of children, how many people get killed, all sorts of ritual elements are used in the names, and certainly in the time of the year that these things happen. Of course, one has to be into astrology, like we just talked about a few minutes ago. In order to decode that, you have to be into the occult. You have to understand astrology. Mm-hmm. You have to understand sidereal astrology, Sabian astrology. There's a whole study there of why these things are done, not only assassinations and killings, but even the outbreaks of war on various festival days, in various signs of the zodiac, and all of the occult symbolism behind that, that the average horoscope person who studies horoscopes is not aware of, because there's actually 88 constellations in the sky, not 12. And the powers that be, the elite, know about the symbolism of all of these various different constellations. They use them in advertising continually, and they also use them when it is to do with the declarations of war or any sorts of agreements, for instance, like a lot of the different agreements, a lot of the different United Nations policies or the EU mandates and what have you. There's a tremendous study in just when these things are launched in the public eye. This also has to be borne in mind.
Well, while we're on that subject, Michael, I'm going to run a situation past you as pertains to what appeared to be, well, not really, what, it wasn't really a random, because it was the district attorneys who handled this case felt that this was a particular motive, but And I'm not going to mention the names of the principals, but the case was detailed on Crime Stories. It is available on VHS. We'll look up the case entitled The Babyface Killer. What happened was that this individual took a gun and basically execution style, emptied the clip, if you may, into the head of her babysitter. Now, the perpetrator was obviously arrested and sentenced to life in prison. He's still in prison now. But the thing that we found as we were looking back at the issue and kind of giving it a relative link, potential link to the occult, we noticed that the mother of the perpetrator, it was weird because whereas you would think that their life would be kind of move on a plane where, they're just hanging in there and trying to do their best they can, but it seemed that physically and materially the mother benefit got a bigger house, got a brand new Mercedes Benz. So when I take a look at this ritual, it's almost this ritualistic type killing taking place in the old house, and then the daughter being sent away to prison, but then the mother benefiting, when you take a look at that, it makes you wonder because, as you said, they're ritualistic implication in terms of the dates and the times and what is done. This particular situation, how do you reflect upon that?
Well, I don't have a specific case, but of course, I've studied so many of these, and it's absolutely a no-brainer to me that this kind of ritual element is involved. All over America, all over the world, any type of mass killings, especially like the ones that happened in Georgia, a few years back, and ones that are happening continually all the time. There are these basically satanic movements out there, satanic orders that are just loose in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, these are always put before you as some sort of freak incident.
Right.
Can you imagine a particular family who has maybe been generationally involved in forms of satanic ritual abuse or mind control? Are those people going to operate naturally? If they put it before you later on as some individual mother, individual father, but how do we know what the real history of these so-called families is? And obviously, it goes without saying that if a person immersed in these different cults, just like David Berkowitz has elaborated in his testimonials that came out later, the person is under incredible stress and can snap at any time. And therefore, this turning on their own children, or they're even shooting and killing themselves, suddenly having some other kind of, could be one of the responses at the end of the line when these people have reached the end of the line. And of course, then the media has to put it before you in a different way. And this is what we get. We get the spin. But we have, we have an entire network out there that people are doing, the media is doing its best to make sure that we don't find out about, even though basically those who've studied it know that it's out there. People who followed the work of Ted Gunderson,
mm-hmm,
and other, John DeCamp and so many other great researchers have exposed this. And again, John Coleman comes to mind because he's explained how this is done within even the corridors of power. When they want to remove a particular politician, when they want to remove a particular dignitary, when they want to supplant a potentate that is suddenly not playing the game anymore, just like John F. Kennedy, perhaps, was a scenario like that. And it goes right up the fractal, even to the past war. For instance, people will look back at history and see footage of the German bombings, let's say, of London and Coventry and the different towns in England, and lament that as being, look, here's the foreign enemy devastating those cities. But do they ever think about the fact that not only was this the war, the Second World War, orchestrated by the shadow government, but think of your opportunity as the Illuminati when, say, London is burning, or France is burning, or Dresden is burning. Isn't it another way in the middle of all of that chaos, who's going to notice if a certain family that hasn't been playing the game is suddenly removed? It's like the broken china hides the plaster, or the broken plaster hides the single piece of china. when you have world war, when you have chaos, you can now remove businesses, businessmen, individuals, politicians, families, and you can turn around and go, well, not too bad, because that street or that business or that district was bombed by the Germans.
Mm-hmm.
And who in the middle of all of that unbelievable, mind-numbing, soul-destroying chaos is going to notice if an entire college or a school or a business or an individual or a family is wiped out? Nobody will do it. So under the guise of, this is almost an uncharted, I don't know anybody else who's even really gone into this, but all the individuals and strongly aware, philosophically aware, brilliant people whose lives were destroyed and their families murdered during times of the Blitz, during the times of, you know, like what appears to be a chaos.
Mm-hmm.
So again, you can read it in their own writing. They will tell you that more can be accomplished in 1 year of war than could be accomplished in 15 years of peace. And there's a very deep meaning in that. What they mean is you can also take out your enemies. And you can do this in a position like the 9/11, where there's even rumors that that is also what happened, not just with documents in Building 7, but individuals were taken out.
Right.
You know, like O'Neill and others as well. And this is ties into what you're saying, because in the flurry of different chaos, it's like General Archibald Wavell said, it's a juggling act, it's like a game, like you were asking earlier on. When you're looking at the right hand, you don't see what the left hand is doing. So in the middle of all of this chaos, they can easily come and eradicate an individual, a group of people. These are people who are not adverse to taking down an entire jet, a plane full of 400 people just in order to kill one.
Right.
These are people who are not adverse to shooting down a plane or having a plane come down with 88 military personnel, which is what happened during the Bush era, in which generals who were ready to stand up against the Trump suddenly died in mass in a particular plane crash. You see. So when we see all these natural disasters, even up to this, like I was saying, even up to the level of full-blown war, let alone more limited skirmishes that happen, we have to also look a little bit microscopically, like detectives, look at the big Holocaust, the big problem, but then also start to study, what else was going on here? Mm-hmm. The son of John Kennedy, who was taken out, they made that look like this incident. So there's all of this as well, and they create a lot of chaos, and then people don't even notice the sort of the other crimes that have happened sinisterly, and then you come along and try to talk about it, they think you're crazy.
Right. Well, why, what you just touched on in terms of chaos being utilized as an apparatus to remove businesses, governments, and individuals, that really is my whole point in terms of the whole 28 days later potential scenario. Because if you really, really wanted to implement, governmental systems, whether they be local or state, or even national, this kind of situation would bring about so much chaos that it would be very, very easy for some of the major foundations, some of the major governmental apparatus to be removed. So why not? I mean, hell, when you're dealing with a situation in a hell on earth type of situation, there's no time to protest. There's no means to go out there and bullhorn. You can. You're in a fight for your life.
Any more than the people could protest when in the First and Second World War, when the troops, I don't care if it's the Allies or whoever it was, can suddenly come in and kick down your door and occupy your house as a strategic position.
Mm-hmm.
To fight the enemy. This is done. You have no say. They're going to turf you out and just literally take over your castle, your houses, your buildings, not only for medical purposes, to, put the wounded
right
in these stately homes. And you see this kind of thing going on today, in which tomorrow, when they have the cashless society and everybody's finances are under one card or in one supercomputer, how easy it will now be to target an individual that they want to shut down. Suddenly they can freeze your assets, they can freeze your money, they can completely screw up all of your bank accounts, they can destroy your credit. Not only that, but the IRS can come down on you. This is shown in the movie Brotherhood of the Bell,
mm-hmm.
where they show that anyone, be it an insider who tries to turn coat, or whether it's an outsider who's causing them too much trouble, this is another way that they can destroy a whole business, a whole enterprise. And I believe very strongly that there should be a history and investigation of this very phenomena in the First and, more importantly, the Second World War in England, just even take England alone, and the removal and the destruction. It's another one of these unsung, unwritten areas of history about how many great families or great individuals with political understanding and political power were removed during this incendiary chaos that was basically manufactured. We know that it happened on the Titanic. We know people like Bill Hughes and others have exposed the fact that there was people on the Titanic, millionaires from America, who were standing against a lot of politics at the time, were standing against America's involvement in international affairs and so on and so forth, and that they were removed, that the Titanic was literally sunk in order to remove a few of these individuals. This has been basically conclusively shown now. There's a lot of evidence for this. And there's innumerable examples of this particular type of scenario. So it really needs to be watched when you have some sort of chaos that goes on where there is this kind of mass death scenario, whether it's the Columbia shuttle, or some other famous historical debacle. We need to look and examine who died and for what reason.
Now, we have about 7 minutes left in our program. With the time that we have left, I want to allow you to discuss something, because we got a movie that's going to be released pretty soon. The trailers have been out, 7 Ways to Sunday, and that's the movie 2012, talking about disasters and cataclysms and the whole world going into the throes of major destruction. Now, you've done a considerable amount of work on 2012, and you deal with the prophecies of 2012. Let's talk a little, as we come on the show, let's talk about 2012 and the future prospects as it pertains also to this topic of architects of control.
Well, it's funny you should mention that, because I'm very opposed to the sort of doomsday perspective that a lot of these documentaries and films focus on. I think it's important to know about the doomsday scenario, but not to focus on it in this traditionally blasé Hollywood way, and this year I've had at least three invitations. One of them was the History Channel, that was just within the last month,
mm-hmm.
to come and do documentaries that will be coming out in the new year, pretty much in I think December, February. This producer told me that they're releasing a History Channel 2012, wanted me to be in it. As soon as I asked for their synopsis, because I always ask TV shows like that, I'm really against going on big shows like that.
Mm-hmm.
But just to be courteous, I always pretend that I'm interested, and then you can send me the synopsis. And of course, it was what do you think it was? Doomsday, again, not really dealing in the spiritual aspects, certainly not dealing on any of the psychological aspects that I go into in my 2012 DVD and work and lectures and talks. That's null and void. They don't even know, they're not even in the starting line when it comes to that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I just politely decline. And I think that that's what's going to happen as the mainstream, let's say, starts getting around the concept of 2012. So in one way, you have to be kind of glad that movies like this and documentaries like this are out, because at least it introduces people to the palette. And hopefully then from that point on, they'll go and study it more assiduously, by YouTube or through books, and study the thing properly through other interviews and shows like yourself. But on the other hand, you've got it sort of pessimistic aspect of it. The downside is that, again, they sensationalize the hell out of it just because they want to sell a movie, or just because they want to sell a bunch of subliminal, these memes, that they're implanting into people's heads about tomorrow. And when you see this anxiety triggers, that's always very worrisome, because, again, they're not empowering people. The idea to empower people to, it's not just about the date 2012, as I go in my work, we're actually in an age of awakening, let's call it an age of revealing. How come they never mention that?
Right.
We've been in an age of revealing now for a good 13 odd years. By 2012, we will have been pretty much in it for about 13 odd years. They never mentioned the cycle. They only mentioned the end date. And it's just ridiculous what they're doing. So we talked about that in the second part of, in the second disc of program one, we went into, again, a little bit more what my own personal concepts are. Henrik wanted to focus on that a lot more and bring out that specific element that talked about the psychology of man and how there will be either a revolution or a devolution in that. Everything you see that we are focused on is predicated on human psychology, including the future to come, the global village, all sorts of sort of totalitarian concepts are all predicated upon how man lends himself to this colonialization and control. And if man is infirm inwardly, if he's basically fragmented in a very infirm state psychically, then Big Brother has the perfectly manipulatable mannequin, because of course they keep pulling the rugs from the external point of view to create fear there, but they're also hoping that they can work on the inner anxiety. And of course, today's world, when people feel anything wrong with their psyche, they immediately run to whom? They run to the pharmaceutical societies, the pharmaceutical monopolies, I mean, and buy into that in order to pacify and alleviate topically without looking deeper. So in my work, we are absolutely obsessed in a way of making sure that the psychological thesis is really strongly brought up in our work. We don't really have time for anything else, really. It's so important, because if we don't insist that man looks at his dark emotions, what he calls his darker emotions, then he is going to be very much vulnerable, susceptible to all these various forms of mind control, be it on the individual level or on the larger level. The whole vaccination thing, the whole global warming thing, all of these things are, again, predicated on that. In fact, Al Gore's global warming thing is entirely a simulacra of a psychological heating up. It's beautiful. It's incredible to study the way that they externalized something that they know is happening psychologically. They played it out on the theater of the external and talked about weather, when all the time, subliminally, they were talking about man's inner temperament. It's really fascinating to watch how they do this. It's really incredible from a psychological perspective. And again, nobody went into that. Nobody ever brought up that all the rhetoric of Gore and all the images and all of the thesis that they were talking about was actually a perfectly designed simulacra to talk to the audience about their psyche, but nobody got it. And that's how clever these puppet masters are. They really are excellent at what they've done. It's really amazing. And through the movies and through the advertisements and the news, they continue to do it.
We have a caller on the line. We've got about 2 minutes left. We'll try to take it real quick. Caller, you're on the air with Michael Tesserian.
Hi, this is Larry from Phoenix, Arizona. With all that's been said, I've been enjoying the program and listening to it. With all that's been said, what can one do other than get involved in the political process of changing and keeping at bay these mind control things that you spoke of and the manipulation of the masses? What else can one do with their life, community, or what have you, to stop this force from commandeering your life, be it your financial situation in your life or your property or what have you?
That's a great question. It goes to the heart of everything.
We got a minute left, so you got to make the answer quick.
Well, the answer is very simple, and that is that the individual must strengthen their own, what I call, psychic immunity.
Yes.
When you know that when the enemy cannot destroy you, when you're so strong that the enemy cannot destroy you, you have won. You can't fight them with any kind of weapon that is other than psychological.
Right.
And psychology means knowing thyself and strengthening one's own immunity so that the enemy has no power over you. In that way, you have won. I go into this a lot in the DVD as well.
Oh, great. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, caller. Well, we are out of time, Michael. We've got about a minute left, and I thank you very much for coming on to this live version of the Investigator's Report. We'll certainly look to probably do it again, maybe in the early part of next year. But, folks, we certainly would like to thank you for joining us for this session of the Investigator's Report. Now, next week, we'll have Walter Matthau on, and he'll discuss the origins of the Bible and who really wrote it. So until that time, may the God of the universe bless you. See you next week. You've been listening to The Investigator's Report, which is produced by Garinger Research and Investigations. For more information on our program and to listen to past programs on our archive page, you can go to our website at theinvestigatorsreport.wordpress.com. That address again is theinvestigatorsreport.wordpress.com. We trust you enjoyed this informative and provocative program, and we urge you to join us for our next session of The Investigator's Report right here on this station.